أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful.
Assalamu alaikum. Hello. Welcome to the Sufi Study Circle podcast. I am your host, Bill Whitehouse, and my Sufi friends call me Anab. I have been traveling sometimes more quickly and sometimes much more slowly on the Sufi path for over 40 years. I am not a Sufi sheikh, but I would like to use the contents of this podcast as a means of sharing with you some thoughts, ideas, possibilities, values, and principles concerning the Sufi spiritual way. Each edition of the Sufi Study Circle podcast will feature various selections concerning poetry, essays, readings from traditional sources, and reflections that give expression to different dimensions of the Sufi path. In addition, there also will be several musical interludes included that offer a change of pace of sorts. So relax, melt into the comfort of your chair, close your eyes, and permit me to take you on an excursion through some of the unrestricted regions of the Sufi spiritual path.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful.
والفجر وليال عشر والشفع والوتر والليل إذا يسر هل في ذلك قسم لذي حجر ألم تر كيف فعل ربك بعاد إرم ذات العماد التي لم يخلق مثلها في البلاد وثمود الذين جابوا الصخر بالواد وفرعون ذي الأوتاد الذين طغوا في البلاد فأكثروا فيها الفساد فصب عليهم ربك سوط عذاب إن ربك لبالمرصاد.
By the dawn and 10 nights and the even and the odd and the night when it departeth, there surely is an oath for thinking man. Dost thou not consider how thy Lord dealt with the tribe of Ad, with many-columned Iram, the like of which was not created in the lands, and with the tribe of Thamud, who clove the rocks in the valley, and with Pharaoh firm of might, who all were rebellious to Allah in these lands, and multiplied iniquity therein? Therefore, thy Lord poured on them the disaster of his punishment. Lo, thy Lord is ever watchful.
فَأَمَّا الْإِنسَانُ إِذَا مَبْتَلَاهُ رَبُّهُ فَأَكْرَمَهُ وَنَعَّمَهُ فَيَقُولُ رَبِّي أَكْرَمَنْ وَأَمَّا إِذَا مَبْتَلَاهُ فَقَدَرَ عَلَيْهِ رِزْقَهُ فَيَقُولُ رَبِّي أَهَانًا كَلَّا بَلْ لَا تُكْرِمُونَ الْيَتِيمَ وَلَا تَحَاضُّونَ عَلَى طَعَامِ الْمِسْكِينَ وَتَأْكُلُونَ التُّرَاثَ أَكْلًا لَمَّا وَتُحِبُّونَ الْمَالَ حُبًّا جَمًّا.
As for man, whenever his Lord trieth him by honoring him and is gracious unto him, he saith, My Lord honoreth me. But whenever he trieth him by straitening his means of life, he saith, My Lord despiseth me. Nay, but ye for your part honor not the orphan, and urge not on the feeding of the poor. And ye devour heritages with devouring greed, and love wealth with abounding love.
كلا إذا دكت الأرض دكا دكا وجاء ربك والملك صفا صفا وجيء يومئذ بجهنم يومئذ يتذكر الإنسان وأنى له الذكرى يقول يا ليتني قدمت لحياتي فيومئذ لا يعذب عذابه أحد ولا يوثق وثاقه أحد يا أيتها النفس المطمئنة ارجعي إلى ربك راضية مرضية فادخلي في عبادي وادخلي جنتي.
Nay, but when the earth is ground to atoms, grinding, grinding, and thy Lord shall come with angels rank on rank, and hell is brought near that day, on that day man will remember, but how will the remembrance then avail him? He will say, Ah, would that I had sent before me some provision for my life. None punisheth as he will punish on that day. None bindeth as he then will bind. But ah, thou soul at peace, return unto thy Lord content in his good pleasure. Enter thou among my bondmen, enter thou my garden.
The foregoing selection gave expression to Surah 89, Al-Fajr, or Daybreak, recited by Qari Wahid Zafar Qasmi. In the previous recitation, mention is made of the great achievements of different people and civilizations, accomplishing things that had never been done before. This resonates with much that is transpiring today, as many people laud the great achievements of modern science and technology. And yet, one can't help but wonder if anything has really changed, since, more often than not, the great accomplishments of modernity entail many environmental, social, political, economic, conceptual, educational, and spiritual problems for the people of today and tomorrow, issues of an inordinate nature that reflect the words of Surah 89 in the Quran. In the midst of all of the foregoing sorts of inordinate occurrences, we become enamored with love of wealth, consuming and laying waste to everything in sight, as we forget the importance of the principle that whatever wealth we have been given is a trial, to test, among other things, what will win out. On the one hand, our desire for consumption and love of wealth, or on the other hand, the desire to feed the poor, to help the orphan, and to work towards developing a tranquil soul that is well pleased with God and with which God is well pleased. For each of us, time is running out on the opportunities that God has afforded us in this life. The following information is intended for first-time listeners and can be skipped during return engagements, if there are any, to the Sufi Study Circle podcast. It only lasts a few moments, but it helps set a context for the podcast, and therefore I consider it important. My Sufi guide passed away more than 25 years ago. Not a day goes by that my thoughts don't turn to him in various ways. I first met him in the fall of 1972. In early November of that year, he asked me to meet with him at a local mosque after the evening prayers. It was the time of fasting, and among other things, he was meeting with some of the individuals who had taken initiation through him and thereby had stepped on to the Sufi path. At the time of the meeting, I was not a Muslim or a Sufi, but on that occasion a zikr or chant had been given to me by him. Almost immediately upon beginning to recite the chant, my condition changed, and that state continued for a time after I stopped saying the Arabic phrase that had been given to me. I wish I could say that my life up to that point was deserving of such an experience, but I can't. The experience was a pure gift of grace, neither earned nor deserved. For the next 16 years, I worked on myself under the guidance of my spiritual teacher. for a variety of reasons, this was both the most difficult and most exhilarating period of my life. At a certain point during my relationship with my spiritual guide, I was drawn closer and asked to take on a variety of responsibilities. One of the responsibilities being alluded to involved being chairperson for the Sufi Study Circle at the University of Toronto, where I was doing graduate studies in education. My duties as chairperson included leading a discussion group that lasted for several hours and took place on a weekly basis. The meetings were small and generally consisted of half a dozen people, but from time to time, 10 or 12 people might show up at those meetings. Sometimes no one showed up at those gatherings except me. For the ensuing 12 to 13 years, with perhaps only a few rare absences taking place due to unavoidable life contingencies, I showed up every Wednesday evening at those meetings. I continued on as chairperson for several years after my guide passed away from this life in 1988, but at a certain point I withdrew from those gatherings. However, in a sense, many of the activities undertaken by me since that time have been variations on a theme, namely, engaging in one form or another of communication that were, in many ways, like the Sufi Study Circle revisited. Over the years, these forms of communication have included websites, blogs, podcasts, books, and talks. Around 2006, I began a podcast entitled Sufi Reflections. For the most part, that podcast was released every few months or so, but there were periods in which those programs were issued both more frequently as well as less frequently. I produced Sufi Reflections for about 5 to 6 years before discontinuing it. One regular feature of that podcast involved a political commentary. The present Sufi Study Circle podcast will not involve such commentaries. It will be offered in the spirit with which the aforementioned real-world Sufi Study Circle meetings were conducted. Each program of the Sufi Study Circle will journey into the ideas, principles, values, and teachings of the Sufi path. This will be done through poems, prose writings, sayings, meditation, and prayers that, over the years, have been given expression through the Sufi mystical spiritual tradition, as well as through occasional short stories and musical interludes. I am not a Sufi sheikh. I am not a spiritual teacher. I am not seeking converts, followers, or the like. Nonetheless, by the grace of God, I did not come away empty-handed from my period of spiritual apprenticeship. Think of the Sufi Study Circle podcast as a sort of oasis in the darkness of the modern world, an oasis where things learned elsewhere are exchanged during the spoken encounters that take place near the watering hole within and against the backdrop of a flickering fire of a desert oasis, and then people are free to continue their journey in whatever way they wish when they move beyond the perimeter of such an oasis. I am seeking to share a spiritual orientation with anyone who might be interested, without any purpose other than the one stated through the podcast. Whatever is part of any given edition of the Sufi Study Circle podcast is intended merely as food for thought, the sort of food which, for various reasons, is becoming increasingly difficult to access in a very troubled world. The foci of the Sufi Study Circle podcast will be reflection, hope, inspiration, possibility, transformation, potential, character, remembrance, balance, transcendence, and sincerity. Such themes are in short supply in all too many geographical locations. God willing, I am going to try to produce a new edition of the Sufi Study Circle podcast each week. However, whether or not such intentions will be realized depends on the enabling power, or tawfiq, and himmah, spiritual aspiration, with which I might be supplied by the one who makes such activities possible. The foregoing introduction will be featured in every edition of the Sufi Study Circle podcast. It remains in place for people who might stumble upon the program for the first time. However, with respect to those individuals who decide to continue listening to future editions of the podcast, you can skip through this section and begin with the portion of things that will be unique for any given subsequent podcast. God willing, my intention is to release the Sufi Study Circle podcast between sunset on Thursday evening and sunset on Friday. I have given myself 24 degrees of freedom with respect to the time of release because life often has a way of interfering with schedules that are wound too tight. Friday is an auspicious day for Islam, as well as Tasawwuf, or the Sufi mystical path. For instance, Thursday evening, or Friday morning in lunar terms, is a time when Sufi groups assemble in different localities around the world. Moreover, Friday is a day when Muslims gather for the midday prayer and a khutbah or sermon is given prior to those prayers. I have given the title Friday Thoughts to this section of the Sufi Study Circle podcast. Friday Thoughts does not follow the format of a khutbah, and yet, like a khutbah, it seeks to give expression to an array of ideas, values, and principles that are meant to be shared with those who are listening. Words that are intended to echo in the hearts, souls, and beings of attendees throughout the rest of the day, if not the following week and perhaps beyond. The themes of Friday thoughts will be varied. However, God willing, they will reflect a Sufi perspective. Today's edition of Friday Thoughts is entitled Spiritual Abuse. When I went to Canada in the late 1960s to give expression to my opposition to the Vietnam War, my life was in a very fluid condition as far as being open to new possibilities and ideas was concerned. Change of one kind or another was the zeitgeist that permeated many things that were taking place in my life, as well as the fabric of the lives of many of the people that I encountered. Although I began my undergraduate days as a pre-theological student, intending at some point to enter the ministry, nevertheless, by the end of my first year of university, I began to question a lot of my previous ideas concerning life, as well as to reassess how suited I might be for the ministry. As a result, I went through a period of agnosticism, in which the issue of God's existence and what that might mean for my life were put on a back burner as I struggled to survive academically, emotionally, financially, and physically. 5 years later, I left the United States with perhaps $100 in my pocket, no car, few possessions, unemployed, without a place to live, and no one that I knew who could help me out when I arrived in Canada. My situation was fairly bleak, and yet, even though I had put God on the back burner in my life, God had not done the same with respect to me. By virtue of a number of seemingly chance events, an elderly Canadian couple who were expatriates of England, and whom I did not know, gave me a place to stay shortly after I arrived in Canada, even though they were not quite sure how they felt about people like me who were war resistors. Their kindness helped bridge a difficult period during the first several months of life in Canada, but eventually things began to become more stable in a variety of ways. At a certain point, after immigrating to Canada, following several different jobs and living arrangements later on in my new homeland, I began to become interested in revisiting the issue of spirituality. However, I had broadened the scope of my search to various possibilities beyond Christianity, including Zen Buddhism, Taoism, the Vedanta, Native American spiritual traditions, the teachings of George Gurdjieff, as well as the mystical dimension of Islam, namely the Sufi path. Through a circuitous chain of seemingly unrelated and improbable events, which I won't bother to recount at this time, I came in contact with someone who was said to be a Sufi sheikh or spiritual guide. Prior to this time, I had almost no knowledge about Islam. In fact, my first encounter with a Muslim was when I worked in a private psychiatric facility in Massachusetts between my second and third year of university. The individual was a patient in the facility. During this period of revisiting the issue of spirituality, I was searching for something that was hard, if not impossible, to put into words, but something that somehow would resonate with me and which I felt I would know if or when I encountered it. However, the search was very chaotic, and I really didn't know what I was doing. Despite my ignorance, God took me by the hand and introduced me to a traveler of the Sufi path. As I indicated in a previous podcast, I entered into an altered state of consciousness shortly after being given a zikr or chant to do by that individual. For the next 16 years, under the direction of my Sufi guide, I worked very hard on trying to become a better person than I had been prior to meeting him. However, when he passed away in 1988, I felt the need for further spiritual assistance, and since my previous spiritual guide left this world without appointing someone to continue his work, I began to search for another Sufi teacher. In a lot of ways, I was still pretty naive about many things, although at the time of my sheikh's passing away, I was aware, to a certain degree, of the fact that there were some groups and individuals in the West who were trying, fraudulently, to pass themselves off as authentic sources of Sufi spirituality. I thought that if I eliminated such groups and individuals from my search parameters, then whatever was left might provide me with some worthwhile candidates from which to select a possible future course of action. Within such narrowed search parameters, I came in contact with a number of different allegedly Sufi groups, and as well, I came in contact with a number of individuals who various people were claiming were authentic, if not highly esteemed, Sufi teachers. In some instances, the spiritual chemistry didn't seem right, and therefore I shied away from such groups and individuals, whereas in other instances, I ran away from possible opportunities as fast as I could because I detected the presence of what I consider to be signs of inauthentic teachings and behaviors in such groups and in relation to their guides. Eventually, and very gradually, I was brought into the sphere of influence of someone who was said to be a Sufi spiritual guide. In fact, several years passed between the time when I first became aware of the existence of such an individual and the time when I actually first interacted with him on a face-to-face basis. Prior to meeting the Sufi teacher, there were a number of other individuals that I knew in both Toronto and Ottawa who had gone down to visit the Sheikh in the United States. They all came back with glowing reports and considerable enthusiasm concerning their experiences with the man. After I finally met the foregoing person, I was quite impressed. The individual was intelligent, funny, easygoing, charismatic, and even more importantly, exhibited considerable knowledge concerning the Quran, Hadiths, Sufi poetry, a history of the Sufi spiritual tradition, as well as the way of the world and the nature of human beings. Knowledge that I was able to verify independently because I had learned many of the same things through my years of listening to my previous Sheikh speak about such matters. By the grace of God, my previous Sheikh had drawn me close to him. As a result, by the time he had passed away, I had a fairly reputable position within the group that had gathered around our Sheikh, but as well I was fairly well known within the larger Muslim and non-Muslim communities. Despite such relative heights, I was ready to start all over again at the bottom with a new Sheikh. My intention to learn more about the Sufi path and myself were sincere. I had no expectations about being treated in any way except in a manner that, God willing, might assist my spiritual progress. It was with the foregoing sort of niyat or intention that I sought and became initiated by the new Sufi Sheikh. Consequently, it was with considerable surprise when the Sheikh indicated to me, almost immediately following my initiation, that I was myself to assume the responsibilities of being a spiritual guide within his Sufi order, that this was something that his own Sheikh had instructed him to do quite some time ago, to initiate me and then to inform me of my new duties. I learned afterwards that my new Sheikh had gone to some trouble to ensure that one of the people in the group who knew about the foregoing directives of the Sheikh's Sheikh should not so much as hint to me about what was to come prior to my asking for or receiving initiation. This latter individual did such a good job of not disclosing the future plans that, as I indicated earlier, I considered myself to be starting all over again with a new group and a new Sheikh. In other words, as far as I was concerned, the slate of the past in terms of whatever position, status, reputation, and so on I might have had in my old group was being wiped clean, and I was proceeding anew. As had been the case during the previous 16 years or so with my first Sheikh, the next 11 years with my new Sheikh were filled with a lot of ups and downs. Due to a variety of interacting factors, my social, emotional, financial, family, and work lives were turned upside down on a fairly regular basis, while in the midst of such upheavals, I tried to faithfully observe my duty as a fledgling Sheikh and would-be continuing traveler along the Sufi path. One of the biggest differences between my interaction with my first Sheikh and the second one was that in the former instance I spent a great deal of time in the presence of my Sheikh, whereas in the latter instance, much of my interaction with the second Sheikh was long distance in nature. To be sure, there were weeks when the second Sheikh was physically present, and as a result, I had the opportunity to spend a lot of time with him. Nonetheless, for the most part, he was physically absent, either spending much of his time in some other country or distant city that, in practical terms, was inaccessible to me. About 11 years into my relationship with the new Sheikh, a number of events took place that I won't detail. The result of those events is that I came to learn that the alleged Sheikh had not been honest and forthcoming with me about a number of matters. He often proclaimed to me that due to my standing within the Sufi group, that he was under the obligation to keep me abreast of any and all matters that concern the Silsila or Sufi order, that there was no information concerning the Silsila that he would keep from me. This turned out not to be true in a number of extremely important ways. In addition, I came across evidence indicating that the so-called Sheikh had not told the truth to me and to a number of other individuals who were associated with the group about a number of matters. Furthermore, I also discovered later on that the alleged Sheikh had been telling untruths about me to various individuals. These instances of taking liberties with the truth were not minor white lies. They were major indiscretions that affected people's lives in essential ways. In addition, information came to me from independent sources indicating that on numerous occasions, the alleged Sheikh had been conducting himself in ways that were unbecoming to anyone who considered himself to be and was considered by others to be a spiritual guide. With much pain, regret, and chagrin, I disengaged from the individual who was calling himself, as well as being referred to by others, as a Sheikh. One of the immediate consequences of the foregoing withdrawal concerned my status as a Sheikh in my own right. If the individual who had sanctioned me as a Sheikh was a charlatan, then such sanctioning was fraudulent, and consequently I no longer considered myself to be a spiritual guide and informed people of this change in status. For a time after the disengagement, I went through a period of spiritual freefall. Many people who undergo the experience of spiritual abuse tend to encounter such rough spiritual waters, and in fact, all too many of them tend to permanently drift away from any active involvement in the spiritual life following their trip over the rocky, hazardous waterfall of realization concerning the reality of having been spiritually abused. Up to a certain point in time, people who come to learn that they have been spiritually abused feel that they have been sailing along, feeling protected and acting in accordance with what one believed to have been sound navigational counsel concerning one's venture into the mysterious waters of the mystical unknown. Yet in the very next moment, the sense of protection and safety has been ripped away, and one is left to face the dreaded sea serpents of terrifying doubt, mistrust, betrayal, disappointment, depression, and dissociation, seemingly on one's own. Although it took me a while to regain my spiritual bearings following my withdrawal from the spiritual charlatan, nonetheless, by the grace of Allah, I was able to pull myself out of the deep, troubling waters in which I found myself and climb back into a spiritual vessel that, as shabby as it might be, nonetheless helped keep me afloat. Since that time, I have learned a few things about how to re-engage the spiritual journey. As odd as it might sound, I am grateful to Allah for having permitted me or even induced me to go through the experience of spiritual abuse. I feel the 11 years that I spent in association with a fraud has helped to enrich my spiritual development in important ways. The tuition for receiving such an education was quite high. However, somehow, with God's help, I was able to come up with the means to pay the costs associated with such a program. Someone might note that if I am willing to acknowledge that my second experience with a so-called Sheikh was inauthentic, then why should I suppose that my first experience with an alleged Sheikh was authentic? Isn't it possible that the first experience with an alleged Sheikh was as fraudulent as the second person turned out to be, and that I just never discovered the presence of spiritual abuse in relation to the first individual? Yes, the foregoing possibility is a consideration. Maybe all of my encounters with people who allege to be genuine spiritual guides need to be critically reassessed. Spiritual understanding is often very subtle, nuanced, and layered in its properties. Of course, anyone can look at my life from the outside and raise this or that possibility. But there was only one human being who was present during the span of 27 years or so that encompassed experiences with the two individuals who I accepted as my spiritual guide at different points in my life, and that person was me. I have had the opportunity to critically review events in relation to both of the foregoing individuals. Indeed, I have done this on a number of occasions. After an exhaustive process of reassessing those years of my life, I am quite comfortable in concluding that one of the two individuals was an authentic Sheikh, while the other individual was a spiritual fraud. Nevertheless, I learned valuable spiritual lessons in conjunction with both of those individuals. A number of people have voiced the opinion that a spiritual charlatan would not be able to deceive them, that they would be able to identify a fraud if they encountered one. Ironically, some of these people are associated with so-called spiritual guides that I have since learned are themselves spiritual charlatans, some of them quite well known in the West. There is all manner of degrees of spiritual fraud that are possible. Some charlatans are much more adept at their craft than other imposters are. And one of the tricks of the trade is learning how to manage the flow of information. That is, if one can keep people in information isolation, then a clever fraud can frame events in any way he or she likes, and in the process, keep even intelligent people in ignorance. People who are seekers of spirituality are seekers because there are many things they do not know. If they knew all the answers, they wouldn't be seekers of knowledge, but dispensers of such knowledge. Spiritual frauds, if they are skilled, are able to leverage the ignorance of seekers and use it as a tool of manipulation. Seekers, even sincere ones, are very vulnerable to psychopaths who wish to misguide others for their own twisted pleasure and purposes. There are many people within the Muslim community who look askance at the whole idea of the Sufi path and believe that anyone who steps onto such a path is misguided and straying from the true Islam. However, my experiences with the two spiritual guides being alluded to here, one authentic and one inauthentic, has sensitized me to the reality that all too much of what is taking place within many facets of the Muslim community is steeped in highly questionable issues of authenticity. Many so-called leaders in the Muslim community claim to give expression to the true teachings of Islam. Based on my evaluation of the situation, some of these individuals are authentic and some of them are not authentic. But differentiating between the two is not always easy or a straightforward process. There are a variety of considerations external to the beliefs, actions, and values of Muslims that account for why the Muslim world is in such a mess. Nonetheless, a very important reason why the Muslim world is in the shape it is in is because all too many Muslims have never learned or been assisted to learn to distinguish between what constitutes authentic and inauthentic Islam, have never been taught how to distinguish between fraudulent leaders and spiritually adept leaders. All too many Muslims have allowed themselves to be guided by people who do not have the Muslim community's best interests at heart, and such fraudulent guidance has induced all too many of us to become susceptible to being invaded by many deadly infectious agents that are present in the world. Early on in my life, I thought I knew the difference between the authentic and the inauthentic. Years of experience, some of it quite bitter and difficult, has demonstrated to me that the issue of spiritual authenticity is a lot more complex than one might naively suppose. Finding someone one can trust with matters that are of essential importance to one's spiritual well-being is an inherently difficult and risky process. Unfortunately, we live in a world that has become increasingly devoid of such trustworthy individuals, and we can see the problematic impact of that sort of absence almost everywhere we look in the world today. God has not abandoned the world any more than God had abandoned me when I entered into an ill-fated relationship with someone who would later be revealed as a spiritual charlatan. However, God is permitting us all to come face to face with the difficult realities surrounding and permeating the process of having to learn how to differentiate between the spiritually authentic and inauthentic in everyday life as well as along the mystical way. Since the beginning of time, there have been an unimaginably large number of choices that have been made by the beings that populate the universe. Relative to all the choices that have been made, or could have been made, your virtually infinitesimal minute choice has induced you to be listening to the Sufi Study Circle podcast. Thank you. Poetry is a form of communication that, when done well, seeps into one's mind, heart, and soul, resonating with one's being long after the spoken words have evaporated into the vastness of space. Yet every poem is vulnerable to the possibility of being distorted by the emotional and conceptual filters through which it is received. Moreover, although the foregoing vulnerability is present even when a poem is not translated from another language, the presence of translation opens up the possibility of considerable distortion entering into the way in which the underlying sense of a poem is engaged. Poetry is often filled with allusions, nuances, subtexts, idioms, similes, metaphors, and wordplay that don't necessarily remain intact when revealed within the context of another language. Just as the Quran cannot be reduced to how a given individual translates its meanings, so too Sufi poetry often does not travel intact from one language to another. Thus, for example, what was actually intended in a given passage of Rumi's original text might or might not be captured accurately, partially or wholly, by the way in which a given individual translates such a passage. Every edition of the Sufi Study Circle podcast will contain poetry that is attributed to this or that Sufi poet. Usually such poetry will give expression to someone's translation of an original text that is written in a language other than English. Rather than trying to claim that, for instance, Rumi meant this or that in a given passage of poetry, especially one that is translated, one might fare better if one did not consider such a passage of poetry as necessarily constituting an authoritative representation of what a given poet, for instance Rumi, believed or understood or meant by such a passage. Instead, take the poetry as an opportunity to enter into a process of critical reflection and exploration concerning oneself and one's own relationship with divinity. Something is true not because someone, Rumi or anyone else, said it. Something is true because it reflects the way things are in some given context or on some given level of being. And poets are often held in esteem because they were able, by the grace of God, to reflect some dimension of that truth in an artful manner. The Sufi poets are leaving behind remnants in their words that are rooted in the phenomenology of a spiritual journey that seeks to travel in the direction of a truth that transcends all words. Use poetry as a point of disembarkation of sorts concerning such a journey. Let the words of a poem induce one to search for the truth, to embrace those words as reminders, filtered though they might be by the perspective of a translator or a listener, that there is a truth for which to search, and that there exists a reality that is waiting to be realized in one's life according to one's spiritual capacity and God's grace. The following selection is entitled, Love Endures Hardships at the Hands of the Beloved. It is from the Mathnawi of Maulana Jalaluddin Muhammad Rumi, as translated and abridged by E. H. Winfield. Through love, bitter things seem sweet. Through love, bits of copper are made gold. Through love, dregs taste like pure wine. Through love, pains are as healing balms. Through love, thorns become roses, and through love, vinegar becomes sweet wine. Through love, the stake becomes a throne. Through love, reverse of fortune seems good fortune. Through love, a prison seems a rose bower. Without love, a grate full of ashes seems a garden. Through love, burning fire is pleasing light. Through love, the devil becomes a houri. Through love, hard stones become soft as butter. Without love, soft wax becomes hard iron. Through love, grief is as joy. Through love, goals turn into angels. Through love, stings are as honey. Through love, lions are harmless as mice. Through love, sickness is health. Through love, wrath is as mercy. Through love, the dead rise to life. Through love, the king becomes a slave. Even when an evil befalls you, have due regard. Regard well him who does you this ill turn. The sight which regards the ebb and flow of good and ill opens a passage for you from misfortune to happiness. Thence you see the one state moves you into the other. One opposite state generating its opposite in exchange. So long as you experience not fears after joys, how can you look for pleasure after disgust? While ye fear the doom of the angel on the left hand, men hope for the bliss of the angel on the right. May you gain two wings. A fowl with only one wing is impotent to fly, O well-intentioned one. Now either permit me to hold my peace altogether, or give me leave to explain the whole matter. And if you mislike this and forbid that, who can tell what your desire is? You must have the soul of Abraham in order with light to see the mansions of paradise in the fire. Step by step he ascended above sun and moon, and so lagged not below as a ring that fastens a door. Since the friend of God ascended above the heavens and said, I love not gods that set, so this world of the body is a breeder of misconceptions in all who have not fled from lust. When I served as chairperson of the Sufi Study Circle more than 25 years ago, in relation to the meetings that were held at the University of Toronto's International Student Center near the corner of St. George and College Street, the gatherings featured relatively brief readings from the Sufi literature, both ancient and modern. Such readings were intended to serve as a source of information, as well as constituting stimuli for subsequent meditation and critical reflection. Sometimes such readings would lead to an ensuing discussion, and sometimes they were followed by an extended silence as individuals sought to digest what had been said in a given reading. Although the nature of the present podcast format is such that it is not interactive in the way the real-world version of the Sufi Study Circle was many years ago, nonetheless, some of the flavor of the original meetings can be conveyed by providing a weekly excerpt from one or another great Sufi teacher of the past. The perspective that was expressed in the introduction to the previous section featuring great Sufi poets remains in effect in this portion of the Sufi Study Circle. In other words, do not take the prose passages that are stated in the following excerpt from the Sufi literature as being authoritative because this or that Sufi sheikh or spiritual guide said it. Listen to the following passage from an orientation that is prepared to undertake the struggle that is necessary to try to follow the words back to their nonverbal origins. The words of the Sufi teachers are surface indicators of a journey that is largely nonverbal. Those words are intended to serve as visible signposts of sorts that point in the direction of a seemingly contradictory state of affairs that ultimately the nature of truth transcends all possibility of verbal communication and as such is ineffable and shrouded in mystery. This does not mean that one can make truth anything one likes. Irrespective of whether or not we grasp how the universe operates on any or all of its metaphysical levels, the truth concerning such operations does exist. Reality does have a determinate nature. The Sufi guides have always been very clear that the journey to the truth can never be completed without appropriate and informed assistance. Nonetheless, one can at least begin a portion of the spiritual journey by reflecting on what has been said by travelers of the Sufi mystical path. This week's reading is rooted in the chapter on contemplation from the book Kashf al-Mahjub by Al-Hujwiri, May Allah be pleased with him. The apostle said, quote, "Make your bellies hungry and your livers thirsty and leave the world alone, that perchance ye may see God with your hearts." End of quote. And he also said, quote, "Worship God as though thou sawest him, for if thou dost not see him, yet he sees thee." End of quote. God said to David, "Dost thou know what is knowledge of me? It is the life of the heart in contemplation of me." End of quote. By contemplation, the Sufis mean spiritual vision of God in public and private, without asking how or in what manner. Abul al-Abbas ibn Attah says, in reference to the words of God, quote, "As to those who say, our Lord is God, and who become steadfast," end of quote, and this is from the Quran. In other words, they say, our Lord is God, in self-mortification, and they become steadfast on the carpet of contemplation. There are really two kinds of contemplation. The former is the result of perfect faith, the latter of rapturous love. For in the rapture of love, a man attains to such a degree that his whole being is absorbed in the thought of his beloved, and he sees nothing else. Muhammad ibn Wasi says, quote, "I never saw anything without seeing God therein," end of quote. In other words, through perfect faith. This vision is from God to his creatures. Shibli says, quote, "I never saw anything except God," end of quote. In other words, in the rapture of love and the fervor of contemplation. One sees the act with his bodily eye, and as he looks, beholds the agent with his spiritual eye. Another is wrapped by love of the agent from all things else, so that he sees only the agent. The one method is demonstrative, the other is ecstatic. In the former case, a manifest proof is derived from the evidences of God. In the latter case, the seer is enraptured and transported by desire. Evidences and verities are revealed to him, because he who knows a thing does not reverence aught besides, and he who loves a thing does not regard aught besides, but renounces contention with God and interference with him in his decrees and his acts. God hath said of the apostle at the time of his ascension, quote, "His eyes did not swerve or transgress," end of quote, and this is from the Quran. One account of the intensity of his longing for God. When the lover turns his eye away from created things, he will inevitably see the Creator with his heart. God hath said, quote, "Tell the believers to close their eyes," end of quote, and this is from the Quran. In other words, to close their bodily eyes to lust and their spiritual eyes to created things. He who is most sincere in self-mortification is most firmly grounded in contemplation, for inward contemplation is connected with outward mortification. Saul ibn Abdallah of Tustar says, quote, "If anyone shuts his eye to God for a single moment, he will never be rightly guided for all his life long," end of quote. Because the regard other than God is to be handed over to other than God, and the one who is left at the mercy of other than God is lost. Therefore, the life of contemplatives is the time during which they enjoy contemplation. Time spent in seeing ocularly, they do not reckon as life, for that to them is really death. Thus, when Abu Yazid was asked how old he was, he replied, 4 years. They said, "How can that be?" He answered, "I have been veiled from God by this world for 70 years, but I have seen him during the last 4 years, the period in which one is veiled does not belong to one's life," end of quote. Shibli cried in his prayers, quote, "O God, hide paradise and hell in thy unseen places, that thou mayest be worshipped disinterestedly," end of quote. One who is forgetful of God nevertheless worships him through faith, because human nature has an interest in paradise. But inasmuch as the heart has no interest in loving God, One who is forgetful of God is debarred from contemplating him. The apostle told Aisha that he did not see God on the night of the ascension. But Ibn Abbas relates that the apostle told him that he saw God on that occasion. Accordingly, this remains a matter of controversy. But in saying that he did not see God, the apostle was referring to his bodily eye, whereas in saying the contrary, he was referring to his spiritual eye. Since Aisha was a formalist and Ibn Abbas a spiritualist, the apostle spoke with each of them according to their insight. Junaid said, quote, "If God should say to me, 'Behold me,' I should reply, 'I will not behold thee, because in love the eye is other than God and alien. The jealousy of otherness would prevent me from beholding him, since in this world I was wont to behold him without the mediation of the eye. How should I use such mediation in the next world?" End of quote. Quote, "Truly I envy mine eye the sight of thee, and I close mine eye when I look on thee." End of quote. Junaid was asked, "Do you wish to see God?" He said, "No." They asked why. He answered, "When Moses wished, he did not see him, and when Muhammad did not wish, he saw him." End of quote. Our wishing is the greatest of the veils that hinder us from seeing God, because in love the existence of self-will is disobedience, and disobedience is a veil. When self-will vanishes in this world, contemplation is attained. And when contemplation is firmly established, there is no difference between this world and the next. Abu Yazid says, quote, "God has servants who would apostatize if they were veiled from him in this world or in the next," end of quote. In other words, God sustains them with perpetual contemplation and keeps them alive with the life of love. And when one who enjoys revelation is deprived of it, he necessarily becomes an apostate. Zul Nun says, quote, "One day when I was journeying in Egypt, I saw some boys who were throwing stones at a young man. I asked them what they wanted of him. They said, 'He is mad.' I asked how his madness showed itself, and they told me that he pretended to see God. I turned to the young man and inquired whether he had really said this. He answered, quote, 'I say that if I should not see God for one moment, I should remain veiled and should not be obedient towards him.'" End of quote. Some Sufis have fallen into the mistake of supposing that spiritual vision and contemplation represent such an idea of God as is formed in the mind by the imagination, either from memory or reflection. This is utter anthropomorphism and manifest error. God is not finite that the imagination should be able to define him, or that the intellect should comprehend his nature. Whatever can be imagined is homogeneous with the intellect, but God is not homogeneous with any genus, although in relation to the eternal, all phenomenal objects, subtle and gross alike, are homogeneous with each other, notwithstanding their mutual contrariety. Therefore, contemplation in this world resembles vision of God in the next world, and since the companions of the apostle are unanimously agreed that vision is possible hereafter, contemplation is possible here. Those who tell of contemplation either in this or the other world only say that it is possible, not that they have enjoyed or now enjoy it, because contemplation is an attribute of the heart or seer and cannot be expressed by the tongue except metaphorically. Hence, silence ranks higher than speech, for silence is a sign of contemplation, whereas speech is a sign of ocular testimony. Accordingly, the apostle, when he attained proximity to God, said, quote, "I cannot tell thy praise," end of quote, because he was in contemplation. And contemplation in the degree of love is perfect unity, and any outward expression in unity is otherness. Then he said, quote, "Thou hast praised thyself," end of quote. In other words, thy words are mine and thy praise is mine, and I do not deem my tongue capable of expressing what I feel. As the poet says, quote, "I desired my beloved, but when I saw him, I was dumbfounded and possessed neither tongue nor eye." End of quote. Over the years, and by the grace of Allah, thousands of my books have been purchased by people, as well as a few libraries, located in 20 to 25 countries around the world, from Senegal to Norway, Australia, Japan, Mexico, Brazil, England, Denmark, Germany, South Africa, New Zealand, and more. It might sound impressive, but if I had to live off the proceeds from such books, I would have perished a long time ago had not God found other means of financial support for me. Individually, the books cost anywhere from $7.95 to $25. If a person were to buy the entire collection of books in a real-world format, or even in a virtual format, one would have to spend somewhere around $300. Relatively recently, I have put together a software package that contains the entire collection of the 33 books that, up to the present time, have been issued through me. In addition, I have added 33 pieces of floetry, that is, poems combining rhythm, rhyme, and music, some of which have been featured in the Sufi Study Circle podcast, that if purchased via CD would cost another $20 or so. As well, I have included a number of videos, one of which appears on a DVD that previously was released to the public and goes for around $13. The foregoing software package is priced at $19.95. This constitutes a saving of over $300 when calculated in terms of the cost of the items contained within the software package had they been purchased individually. The software package is entitled Sufi Reflections. If you are interested in obtaining a copy of the software package for 1995, please go to http://anab-whitehouse.com for further information. I don't know of any other person within the Muslim community, at least in North America and perhaps beyond, who has released such an array of diverse, high-quality writings. The topics range from 9/11 to Sharia, psychology, evolution, education, political science, constitutional law, quantum physics, spiritual abuse, cosmology, mysticism, leadership, Islam, moral philosophy, mythology, and history. There is a great deal of food for thought in the foregoing material that is of relevance to and perhaps value for the Muslim community. I might not have all the answers or even any of them. Nonetheless, the aforementioned software package, Sufi Reflections, should, God willing, induce a person to reconsider a great many ideas. I'm not trying to reinvent or reinterpret the Islamic spiritual tradition. Instead, I am trying to draw attention to a variety of issues, ideas, and problems that might adversely affect the way an individual engages Islam. Although I do not have the talent or spiritual stature of Rumi, Hafiz, or even my own spiritual guide, may God be pleased with them all, nevertheless, from time to time, the impetus to write poetry has arisen within me. I have joined such efforts to various musical backgrounds, produced a combination of rhythm, rhyme, and musical overtones that I refer to as floetry, which, in a way, sort of harkens back to the Beat Generation of the late 1940s and early 1950s, when individuals would recite their poetical compositions against the backdrop of the improvised offerings of a group of jazz musicians that shared the stage with the poet. Some of the poems that will appear in this section of the Sufi Study Circle podcast are inspired by life events of my own, while other poems are rooted in the teachings of great spiritual luminaries of the past. In the latter case, I have run someone else's understanding through the filters of my own limitations, but have tried as best I can to retain the spirit of the ideas and sensibilities that were given expression through the original poems or prose of some great Sufi of the past. The following instance of floetry is based on the teachings and writings of Fariduddin Attar. May God be pleased with him. O those who have been consuming the fruit of life while neglecting the deeper root, this is like the false dawn that catches one's vision, leading one to believe the sun is close to rising when this is not so. We have become immersed in games of no worth, where we dream of scoring winning goals and forget truths about losing our souls. Like children, we chase after bubbles that glitter but elude our grasp or burst flat, with emptiness when caressed by our touch. Soon we will lie down at death's door with such regret, sensing that we've been chasing wind as we leave the world behind and begin the real life, knowing we have not prepared for what may come, but spend our time ensnared with worldly affairs made of vanity. We carouse markets of inanity and insanity, squandering our life's potential while playing the ego's fight. The world is a hydra that must be fed, yet no matter how much we give each head what it desires, there are still further cries, insisting on more unsatisfied sighs. Like a greedy rich fool who prays to God to increase wealth and does not find this odd. Remember Pharaoh, whose claims were so bold, or Karun, whose heart was obsessed with gold. History is elusive, like blowing sand that buries memories of knowing. The world is a prostitute who is dressed with allure to trigger the body's quest, to embrace the attraction which clothes hide, if we will just throw discretion aside. Or perhaps we will be seduced by lust, for worldly glory is to be found in the store of rich and powerful sultans or kings, hypnotized by the illusion of things, where banners of fortune changed with the wind, hoisted on ropes woven from finest sin. The temptations of this life are the threads through which a worldly kind of a spider spreads. Sticky filaments on the path that trap heedless humans and suck from them the sap of purpose and leave their carcass to rot on flimsy strings of desire that have brought them each to an unfashionable end, where they'll have nothing of value to send on to offer the master with the broom, who's ready to sweep corpses from the room. All of the things that we have sought and thought are creations of the divine and not our own. God made the atoms that rebelled, and then to the truth would become impelled. From God come stories of sin, contrition, retribution owed, and the condition of forgiveness. God is the seeker, way, and knowledge, masked by the struggle of clay. The triumph that you believe to be your arrival is not, but God at God's door. We're but pane on a mirror from which we are able to reflect divinity. So lost atoms may regain the wisdom to unite with the light of God's prism. This portion of the Sufi Study Circle podcast involves a brief essay or a commentary on topics of importance to everyday life. Every point of the Sufi mystical path is commensurate with principles and values that have practical ramifications for lived life, since the primary measure of practicality will, to one degree or another, always be a function of the truth. Real pragmatism must be rooted in an understanding concerning the forces that impinge on our lives, both from within and without. The essays or commentaries of this segment of the program are intended to probe different dimensions of everyday life from a Sufi perspective. The title of today's meditative selection is Keys. There is not one right way to seek God, but every way one tries must be right. Every right way is a key which unlocks one or another spiritual door. Every incorrect way places further locks and doors between the individual and successful completion of the spiritual quest. Sometimes when people begin to reflect on the potential length and difficulty of the mystical path, there is a tendency for the individual to become overwhelmed. One tries to comprehend all the struggle and sacrifice that will be necessary, and one starts to feel faint-hearted and queasy. The idea of spiritual realization seems so close and palpable, but the ontological and experiential realization of this idea feels so far away. One goes through cycles of excitement and being deeply discouraged. An important key to maintaining perspective through these early ups and downs is to understand that mysticism is a journey which goes at its own unique speed for each individual. However, irrespective of its speed, in one form or another, it will last a lifetime. Like biological, emotional, and intellectual maturation, mystical development takes time. Although various spiritual transformations may take place very rapidly when they do occur, these transformations must be preceded by certain stages and processes which prepare the individual for those changes. Spiritual transformations taken in and of themselves can take place very rapidly. Sustainable spiritual transformations are another matter. Due to our impatience to reach the destination, we want to hook ourselves up to a powerful spiritual booster and blast off. We tend to forget even astronauts go through an extensive training process in order to minimize the risks associated with their journey and in order to prepare themselves for the tasks which must be performed once in orbit. Consonant with and complementary to the foregoing is the importance of pacing oneself on the spiritual path. This is another key to having proper perspective concerning the mystical journey. Ironically, sometimes both the false self and satanic forces will urge one to jump into mystical practice in a big, enthusiastic way. There is a method to this apparent madness. When these heroic efforts don't produce the desired results, as they cannot, since the underlying intention is incorrect, people become disillusioned, disappointed, and frustrated. They become mystical burnouts. The key to pacing is balance. One, simultaneously, must engage in some level of constant spiritual activity in order not to stagnate on the path. Yet the degree of this activity must not be so intense it cannot be sustained over time, and thereby lead to a waning of interest or disengagement from the Sufi path. Whenever the individual raises the level of intensity of her or his spiritual efforts, Sufi masters often suggest these efforts be coordinated within a context of less intense but steady spiritual activity. Moreover, both the more intense as well as the less intense forms of spiritual activity need to be interspersed with brief periods of relaxation to keep one, in a sense, loose and fresh for the spiritual tasks at hand. Every stage of the mystical journey provides keys for subsequent stages of that journey. These keys come in the form of the myriad learning experiences which take place in our day-to-day lives. Sufi masters point out that our whole life is made up of a chain of experiential events. Those events are not chance, arbitrary happenings. Each and every link of the chain is fully intended by God. Each and every event has something to teach us about our relationship with God. Every experiential lesson is a key, or forms part of a more complex key, which can help unlock the meaning of our lives. The spiritual lessons we learn today may help, God willing, open doors along the mystical path tomorrow. Conversely, every inattention concerning these lessons has the potential to create spiritual difficulties later on in our journey. Indeed, one of the reasons why we sometimes tend to run into the same sort of problems in our lives is because we didn't take advantage of all the previous opportunities God had given us to learn the spiritual lessons of life. Every day, God introduces events into our lives which require patience, forbearance, forgiveness, courage, sincerity, charitableness, honesty, perseverance, trust, generosity, compassion, kindness, sensitivity, and humility. Each time we are, for example, patient, we help fashion by the grace of God a key of patience. Each time we have forbearance, then by the grace of God, we help fashion a key of forbearance, and so on. The events of our day-to-day lives provide opportunities for the fashioning of temporary spiritual keys which help resolve, God willing, the immediate problems of our lives. Over time and with God's help, what is temporary becomes permanent. We become patience. We become forbearance. We become forgiveness. Such qualities are very important keys to unlocking as well as giving expression to our spiritual potential. Sufi masters encourage practitioners of the path to seek to work towards fashioning as many of these permanent keys as we can. All of these qualities are correct ways of seeking God because they all reflect divinity and are not possible to acquire except through God's blessings. God wishes our spiritual success. The fact there are so many opportunities in our lives for fashioning the spiritual keys which, God willing, unlock the treasure house of divine favor is a clear sign of God's good wishes for our spiritual well-being. Sufi masters are constantly encouraging initiates to try to find as many ways as possible for seeking and working towards acquiring spiritual keys of one kind or another. One simply doesn't know which key or combination of keys may be most pleasing to God. Bearing witness to the oneness of God is a key to spiritual success. Prayer is such a key. Fasting is this kind of key. Charitableness is a key. Remembrance of God is a key. Repentance is a key. Contemplation of God's signs within us and without us is a key. Good works are a key. Meditation is a key. Gratitude is a key. Dependence on God is a key. And love is a key. No matter how many times one may fail in the pursuit of such spiritual keys, the Sufi masters urge initiates to try again and again and again. Persistence and perseverance are keys as well. On the Sufi path, the master key is the Sheikh. This is so because the spiritual guide is the means through which one learns how to unlock the secrets of all the other spiritual keys. The Sheikh does not replace prayers or fasting or charitableness and so on. Nonetheless, everything of value one learns about the meaning, significance, and reality of these spiritual activities comes through one's spiritual association with the Sheikh. Through the example and presence of the spiritual guide, one learns, God willing, about tolerance, love, kindness, mildness, justice, integrity, commitment, and piety. Through the support, protection, encouragement, and wisdom which God extends to the individual through the Sheikh, one is enabled, if God wishes, to carry on amidst the difficulties, tests, trials, and challenges of the mystical path. The Sheikh is the one who, by the grace of God, not only helps the individual to bring passions and anger into balance, but, God willing, oversees the transformation of these protagonists into spiritual allies. Furthermore, the Sheikh is the one who, with the support of God, helps the individual to cleanse the heart and empty the seer of the world and perfect the spirit. The cleansing of the heart is a key to unlocking one's potential for gnosis of God. The emptying of the seer, that is, the internal spiritual faculty, is a key to unlocking one's potential for witnessing the disclosures of God's manifestations. The perfection of the Spirit is the key to unlocking one's potential for love of God. For all of the foregoing reasons, as well as many others, the Sheikh is the master key through which, by the grace of God, the doors to spiritual identity and essential capacity become unlocked. The Sheikh is a master key because divinity has fashioned her or him to have such a spiritual function. This segment of the Sufi Study Circle podcast, which I refer to as the It Has Been Said feature, will usually be fairly brief. It involves nothing more than a few sentences, and sometimes only one sentence, concerning what someone on the Sufi path is reported to have said at one time or another. The words are given without attribution because the purpose of presenting such thoughts is not to serve as some sort of claim to authoritativeness independent of content, but rather to put forth food for thought that can be considered independently of whomever might have made such a statement. The statements are intended to stimulate reflection. They are not intended to be statements that should be considered as being persuasive because someone of note might have said them, and which then, all too frequently, unfortunately, go on to be misunderstood and or misused by someone who is trying to impose his or her interpretation of things on others. Just consider what is being said. Don't accumulate information for purposes of argument and disputation. Let the ideas flow over your mind and heart. Let them take root there and be cultivated with care to see what fruits might arise from them that, however valuable they might be to you, should not be force-fed to others. Aspire to withdraw all traces of self-interest from your transactions with God. For as long as self-interest is present, sincerity or ikhlas cannot be achieved. Worship motivated by self-interest is like work done for wages, whereas worship motivated by sincerity is work done in the service of God without thought of return. The following segment of the Sufi Study Circle podcast is a brief prayer that is offered on behalf of whomever might have managed to survive to this portion of the program. O our Lord, help us to struggle against, to work to resist, and through your grace to overcome the tendencies within us that are inclined to cede agency to lower dimensions of ourselves that generate ugliness both within and without. This week's edition of the Sufi Study Circle podcast has been brought to you by the Interrogative Imperative Institute, where the process of asking questions becomes an artful journey to solutions for life. You have been listening to the Sufi Study Circle podcast. The host for this program, namely yours truly, is neither a sheikh nor a spiritual guide, nor am I equipped to advise anyone where she or he might be able to formally step on to the Sufi path. When I stumbled into the spiritual tavern of my sheikh, I had no idea what I was doing or how I had found such an establishment. When my sheikh passed away, there were no provisions left in place for anyone else to assume his responsibilities in the future. Since his passing away, I have come to learn, in a very close-up and problematic way, that there are spiritual charlatans who are constantly trolling the waters of existence for vulnerable prey. While I believe there still are authentic spiritual guides who exist in various parts of the world, and unfortunately are becoming fewer in number, I do not have confidence in recommending this or that person as being an authentic shade, which is not to say that such people aren't legitimate, but rather it is to say that I do not feel comfortable in recommending them to anyone as individuals for whom I could give assurances that they are people on whom one can rely spiritually. The contents of the program are intended merely as food for thought. While such food might induce someone to want to journey beyond the very limited horizons of the podcast, please keep in mind that I am of the understanding that the Sufi path cannot be traversed without an authentic spiritual guide. And unfortunately, as indicated previously, there are many fraudulent teachers who are actively seeking opportunities to misguide people and thereby not only muddying the spiritual waters, but attempting to corrupt, if not destroy, the spiritual potential of unsuspecting people. Information concerning past editions of the Sufi Study Circle can be found by going to anab-whitehouse.com/circle, that's capital C, small I-R-C-L-E .htm. Thank you for your time, and perhaps we will convene again in the future during some further God-willing edition of the Sufi Study Circle podcast.